I think it's helpful to think not just, oh my God, this terrible climate change stuff is happening and we're going to have to change our lives and it's all going to be bad, but to recognize that this is kind of an opportunity to change society in hopefully some ways that will be good. Because again, I think most people would say there's ways in which society could be improved right now. And maybe the kinds of changes that climate change will force us to make will be changes that actually have other benefits. Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the Mindspace Podcast. I'm Joe Flanders. Thanks for tuning in. The Mindspace Podcast is my personal, in-depth exploration of the science and practice of well-being. I'm sharing this journey with you because I believe we can all lead happier, more meaningful lives by getting the facts and training our minds. Join me as I learn and share the most inspiring insights about human flourishing from leading experts, because we could all use a little more Mindspace. Do you follow the news about climate change? Does it affect your mood? How well do you understand the underlying mechanisms and the impact on human civilization? Have you thought about what to do about all of this? If you answered yes to any of these questions, today's episode will definitely resonate. I spoke with Professor Susan Clayton, a globally recognized authority on the mental health impact of climate change. Susan is a professor of psychology at the College of Worcester. She is the lead author on an American Psychological Association report called Mental Health and Our Changing Climate. And she's a contributor to the upcoming report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. I myself have been feeling eco-anxious. And based on the research I've been doing and understanding the statistics about this issue, I'm pretty sure I'm not alone. And so I wanted to address it on the podcast. And in doing our research, Susan really stood out as one of the best positioned experts on the topic, and our conversation did not disappoint. We talked about the basic scientific facts about climate change, the mental health impacts, obviously, including eco-anxiety, the economics and politics of climate change, recommendations for building resilience in the face of eco-anxiety, and the possibility of broad social and economic transformation to deal with climate change. If you'd like some support in coping with your concerns about climate change, Mindspace can help. We're launching an eco-anxiety support group in Montreal in January, and we have a few psychologists on staff who really specialize in this area. Please visit mindspacewellbeing.com/eco-anxiety for more information. And if you find the Mindspace podcast valuable, you can support it by leaving a review on iTunes. And you can stay up to date on the latest news about the podcast by joining the mailing list. Links will be available in the show notes for this episode. And now, here's my conversation with Professor Susan Clayton. Susan Clayton, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. How's the day so far?
Oh, it's gray, but it's not raining, and could be better, could be worse.
Okay. Maybe we can start by you just introducing yourself and telling us what you do and why you might be a good person to talk to about eco-anxiety.
Well, okay. My background is that I'm a social psychologist, a PhD in social psychology. I'm currently a professor of psychology and environmental studies at the College of Worcester. And I've been looking into the question of the impact of climate change on mental health and psychosocial well-being, more broadly defined, for some time. So I think I have tried to become familiar with a lot of what's out there on that topic.
And I feel like you teach some classes at Worcester on this topic. Is that fair to say?
I don't teach any classes that are entirely devoted to this. I teach a class on sustainability, which I'm teaching right now. I've taught a class on sort of environment and identity. So some of these topics come up in those classes.
Okay. I want to get into some of the basics about climate change and mental health. And I discovered you through this really important APA report from 2017 called Mental Health and Our Changing Climate. And that really gave me some strong foundations for my own work in this area. And I wouldn't mind kind of going back to some of that basic stuff and just getting our listeners up to date before we move into the more interesting or more controversial topics here. So I think it's fair to say at this point, it is no longer a controversy that the climate is changing and that is at least partly man-made. Would you agree with that?
Well, there's still some people who do not accept that, including some people in very high positions in my country and actually around the world. So it depends on who your social context is, whether you would call that controversial or not. But I think among scientists, it is, and the majority of the public, it's quite settled.
Right. Would it be possible to give us a brief rundown of the basic facts about climate change as we know them right now?
Sure. And I know that you know this, but I want to make sure your listeners know that I'm not a climate scientist. So
right.
I'm not going to get into that kind of level of detail. But absolutely, background is basically that human activities lead to the increased emission of greenhouse gases, would have been called greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide, but also methane and nitrous oxide. And they're called greenhouse gases because they act like a greenhouse structure. So they tend to trap the heat. The sun radiates heat that warms the earth, which is good for us. And then as in a greenhouse, the heat can't get back out as effectively as it would if there were no greenhouse. So the atmosphere tends to get warmer. And there is just a huge body of evidence supporting the idea that the world is warming. I think that would be very hard to deny. And a very solid body of evidence saying that this warming is linked to human activities that produce these greenhouse gases, especially burning fossil fuels, for example. So those facts, I think, are fairly well accepted. One important thing to know about climate change is that the emissions, once they're in the atmosphere, that they'll continue to have an effect. So we have, and the effect doesn't necessarily become felt right away. So the changes we've already made to the environment or to the atmosphere will continue to have an impact. Even if we stopped emitting fossil fuels today, there would continue to be global warming. But we can certainly make changes today that will reduce the level of that global warming from what it would have been otherwise.
Now, you used both phrases, climate change and global warming. Maybe you could explain to us why those phrases are interchangeable and why some people might be experiencing colder temperatures, even though the globe might be warming.
Absolutely. So as I think you know, that global warming was the phrase that was used most commonly probably 10 years ago or probably even less, because on average, the global temperature is getting warmer. And that's one of the pieces of evidence we have to know that this process is occurring. But it's also the case that it's not getting warmer everywhere. And some of the impacts aren't just summed up by talking about warming. So I think more and more the phrase climate change is used to indicate that it's about overall changes to the climate that are not just restricted to levels of to warmer levels of temperature.
Okay, and maybe you can also distinguish between this cause or the mechanism, these greenhouse gas emissions, and the symptoms that we perceive, namely weather events like superstorms, flooding, forest fires. What do all those things have to do with a changing climate?
Right. And part of the, I think the challenge here is to recognize the difference between weather and climate. Weather is what we have on any particular day. And climate is essentially the conditions, the underlying conditions that are associated with one kind of weather or another in the long term. So it comes down to the atmosphere and the trapping of warmth in the atmosphere. And I'm not a meteorologist. I guess if I were, I'd know how to pronounce it. but warmer air holds more moisture. It might, the air currents start to work differently. Warmer air actually also traps more pollutants near ground level. This warmer air actually has, or air with more carbon dioxide in it, has impacts on the way plants grow. So it's astonishing just how wide and varied the impacts are of these increased levels of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Does that answer your question?
It does. It does. Yeah. So I'd be curious to hear from you personally how you got from being a social psychologist to then moving into understanding the mental health impacts of climate change. And so much so that you're actually going to be an author on the upcoming assessment report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which I believe is an important authority in this space.
Absolutely. I think that they are trying to be as authoritative as possible. And certainly, you know, it's internationally, it's made up of, it's a very international body, and it's internationally respected, which is not the same as saying universally respected, but it's really an international source of information. So I think that's really important. This is something we can kind of agree on at a global level. Mm. So I trained in social psychology, study social behavior, and in my sort of early career days was very interested in a variety of social issues and understanding people's attitudes towards social issues. And I just had always been an environmentalist. And, you know, with one thing or another, one thing I do as a psychologist is listen to people a lot and think about what they're saying. And I began to realize that, of course, environmental issues were social issues. Even 20 years ago, even more than that, we knew that people had attitudes about what it meant to be an environmentalist and so on. So I started looking into those issues and how people formed their opinions about environmental issues. And then as I went along, thought more and more about why people care about the environment, why it matters to them. And listening to some of my students as well as other people, recognize that it was a real source of psychological significance, that for some people, their identity is tied up in the natural environment, or it's interconnected, and that being in a natural environment can affect the way you think about yourself and about your relationship to other people. So there are certainly many other people working in this field of environment and psychology, but it's not as many as in some other areas. So probably in the early 2000s, some of us started to try and encourage the American Psychological Association to get more involved in paying attention to environmental issues, because a lot of people weren't recognizing that there was any psychological relevance to these things. Hmm. And so I was involved in a fairly early task force, I think in 2009 with the APA. And then that meant that I sort of got to be one of the people who was known for investigating environmental issues from a psychological perspective. So at some point after that, early 2010s, I think, I was invited to contribute to this report where we started to look at the mental health impacts of climate change. And, you know, to be honest, at that point, I'd given that very little thought, but, and I think a lot of other people hadn't given it thought either, but there was a lot of evidence that when you put it together, it began to suggest that there would be impacts. So just the more I started to look into this topic, the more I realized that there was a lot there that needed to be studied and needed to be highlighted, I think. And one reason I think it's important is because, you know, some people are physically affected by climate change, and that's certainly important to consider. But far more people can be mentally affected by climate change.
Right. Yeah, so I want to hear more about that. I just wanted, something you said kind of got my attention, because I remember this past spring, I was on the West Island of Montreal, going for a walk, and there's some nice places to be outside there. And the area had seen some pretty bad floods. And it was not the first time that this area was affected by flooding, and I sort of got learned from reading about it that this is kind of the new normal for this part of the island of Montreal, that people can pretty much expect most springs for their basements or homes to be flooded, and it's kind of how it is now. And I just remember feeling really disturbed by that, just sort of the magnitude and the scale of the problem, and how how much it's impacting communities and people. And it really sort of stuck with me in a deep kind of existential way. So I'm just curious, what do you make of that, and what are people telling you about how these experiences of climate change affect them psychologically, emotionally, et cetera?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting the way you put that. One is that idea that the idea of something being the new normal is disturbing. And I think that we are talking about a huge shift, and just the idea that things that we took for granted, what was normal, is no longer normal, and we have to define for ourselves a new normal. That's got to take a lot of a lot of cognitive effort, even a lot of emotional effort, because we like to be able to take certain things for granted and have a certain stability to our world. So I think you also used the word existential, and I think that's exactly right. It's a phenomenon that really requires us to change the way we think about our world in a way that, maybe we would rather not be doing, but affects everything.
Right. So given that you've studied this area quite a bit, maybe you can give us a little summary of what the mental health consequences are of climate change.
Absolutely. And I'm going to put them into different categories, and those categories vary in sort of in terms of specificity and also in terms of how much we know about them. So one of the first things I found when I started to look into this issue was there's a lot of research on mental health impacts of natural disasters. And this research has been going on for decades before people were really talking about climate change. But because climate change is likely to increase the number of natural disasters we experience, that becomes relevant. So I think it's very easy for people to understand that, if you survive a hurricane or a flood or a wildfire, that might affect your mental health. And definitely there are documented increases in, post-traumatic stress disorder and depression, anxiety, and also things like substance abuse and interpersonal violence. So things that some people might not think of as mental health problems, but they're clearly related to our well-being. So some of the other things associated with climate change that will affect mental health are actually, they're less obvious, but I think more significant in the long run. And that will be things like rising heat levels, rising sea levels, and changing patterns of precipitation. And we actually have every reason to expect these things to affect mental health. For example, there's decades of research on the effects of heat on aggression. And in fact, recent research has confirmed that higher temperatures are associated with increased levels of intergroup conflict, as well as increased rates of suicide and hospitalizations for mental illness.
Why would that be?
It's not 100% clear. One of the speculations is just that heat is stressful. So when you're stressed, you're just less good at coping with the things that are going on in your life. You're more likely to snap at somebody else if they irritate you, and less likely to be understanding of them. If you're feeling a little bit stressed for other reasons, that heat might be enough to kind of push you over the edge in terms of, again, aggression towards other people, but also aggression to yourself, which is where the suicide comes in. Pollution is actually also associated with mental health problems, particularly, airborne pollutants that you, breathe in as you're developing may result in mental health problems years later, because they've had an effect on the developing brain. that's a little bit more, the research is less clear cut on that, but there's enough evidence to suggest that this is an effect for us to worry about. And then a third way in which these gradual changes in climate can have, I think, a strong impact on mental health is because a lot of them will lead to people losing their homes. And of course, we've already seen this through natural disasters, if your home is destroyed in a storm or a wildfire. But of course, your storm can also be destroyed because you're living on the coast and the coast erodes into the sea, or you're living on permafrost and the permafrost is thawing. Or for many people, their home isn't literally destroyed, but the area where they live is becoming so subject to drought or flooding that it's no longer appropriate for them. It's no longer suitable for human life. So in all these cases, they are forced to move. And in some cases, and we certainly see this in the Middle East, the area is so unsuitable for living that you might decide that you might be forced to migrate to another country. And so losing your home is stressful. People report all kinds of sadness associated with losing their home. It's a source of stability, it's a source of security, it's a source of identity. So there are some very kind of poignant quotes from people talking about how they felt about losing their home in a storm, and they just didn't feel like themselves anymore. But if you're on top of that, forced to migrate to another country, I think we can all recognize how stressful that might be. It's often physically dangerous, and certainly it's very socially challenging. The residents of the new place or new country are not always welcoming. You have to adapt to a new environment and learn how to fit into a completely new kind of place. So not surprisingly, this kind of involuntary migration is a real threat to mental health. And then a last way in which climate change can affect mental health is we don't know that much about this at this point, but it's been attracting a lot of interest recently. And you referred to this when you talked about eco-anxiety. I've been calling it climate anxiety, but essentially those negative emotions associated with the perception that the climate is changing. And this is important. It's hard to study, but it's also important for the same reasons that anybody can be affected by climate anxiety. You don't have to have personally experienced the effects. You're just worried and anxious about the future.
Right. So maybe just a quick one there. Why do you think this is attracting so much attention? I know I've been solicited a bunch of times by the media, and we certainly get some calls about it at the clinic. Why do you think this is the sort of the meme of the moment?
I'm not sure. I think it may be that we just hit a tipping point in terms of recognizing the evidence for human impacts of climate change. So people started to recognize that it was going to affect them and people they cared about, and it wasn't just going to be about polar bears or generations in the future. That's my interpretation. I really don't know why it suddenly became a thing, but clearly people are talking about it. Obviously there's the youth movement that is very concerned about climate change. You have people talking about their grief and forming support groups mm-hmm. to talk about their grief associated with climate change. You have people talking about whether or not they should have children because they're so worried about climate change.
Right. And those are certainly some of the headline-grabbing news items. I want to drill down a little bit into the term eco-anxiety, or climate anxiety, actually. Mm-hmm. Both work for me. One of the things that's interesting is the word anxiety. And typically when I read about the construct, it typically includes more than just the affective state or the mood state of anxiety. And I think it generally refers to like more of a general mood disturbance that could involve insomnia or guilt, or you mentioned the word grief or depression. How do you make sense of that? Is it a general mood disturbance, or do you like to think of it specifically as an anxiety?
No, I agree with you. I use the word anxiety because I think that's the one that people have been using, and it's sort of they get what you say when you refer to eco-anxiety or climate anxiety. But I think of it more as a constellation of negative emotions that, you know, different people are experiencing in different blends, as it were.
Okay. And I wonder if you have any data about who this is affecting.
Well, I have just a very little data. I mean, there a lot of times people want to know, how is this changing over the years? And if, we don't really know, because we weren't asking anybody 10 years ago about this kind of thing. But there have been a number of national surveys that ask people, are you worried about climate change? And about 70% of Americans in the most recent surveys I've seen say they are worried. And about 50% that they will personally be harmed by climate change. So it seems to me that that is, you know, if you think you're personally going to be harmed, that's a reason to be anxious.
Sure. And that's a lot of people.
Exactly. You see different rates in different places. I've seen 40% in France and 56% in Australia talking about this kind of high level of worry. The American Psychological Association does this Stress in America survey, and they found that about 50% of Americans said that climate change was a source of stress for them. And one thing that they found that I've also found is that younger people report greater stress.
Right. I was going to ask you about that. So based on what you know, that is a true statement, that it does affect younger people more than older people?
I believe so. The APA survey, you know, is very, it has a careful methodology and is designed to be a representative survey. So I think if they find that difference, we can feel reasonably confident in it. And then I've just begun doing research in this area. So I've surveyed a few hundred people, you know, definitely not a representative sample, but found the same thing. So the fact that I found it as well suggests to me that it's something we can probably feel somewhat confident in.
Sure. When journalists ask me about this, obviously I don't know why that's the case. But what I speculate about is the fact that younger people, because they have longer to live, may be more affected by it sort of in the long run. Do you buy that?
I think that's likely. I haven't gotten to that point of asking them, you know, why are you worried? But I think a lot of those of us who are not so young anymore, you know, middle-aged, do have the sense that it's a problem we're leaving for these generations. And that's something you'll see in the media. And so if they're paying attention, that's the message they're getting, is that this is your problem.
Right, right. Okay, so not everyone is super pleased about the appearance of this phrase. I'm wondering if you have any reaction to the suggestion that we're sort of medicalizing a real, like even a rational response to a real threat. Or if using these clinical terms kind of diminishes the experience of the person who is experiencing eco-anxiety.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, that that talking about it as anxiety implies that it's a problem of the individual. It's a, you know, it's their psychological issue, and it may take attention away from, well, what is the source of this anxiety? So it focuses on the individual's experience rather than on the kind of societal cause.
Right.
And I think we have to be careful not to fall into that trap. And yeah, that idea that anxiety is a rational response, I think that's important as well. So this is not something, I know I've made this point with other people. You can't necessarily use therapy to tell people why their fears are irrational, because their fears are not irrational.
Exactly, yeah.
On the other hand, I think it's important to, and I think you can, there's beginning to be some evidence for this. You can distinguish between a realistic worry and then people who are becoming impaired by it. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't mean, I think one question people have is you know, eco-anxiety different from other kinds of anxiety? I guess I don't have a position on that, but I would not be in the camp of people saying we need to label this as a clinical disorder.
Right.
Partly for the reasons you talked about.
Right. Although that is an interesting way to carve it up, to talk about the sort of clinical impairment or just functional impairment. Mm-hmm. It's something that I like because ultimately we want people to be moving and taking action and being on the right side of the revolution here. And if people are paralyzed by this fear, it's not helping anybody. And it would be great for mental health professionals or even friends and family to help people learn to manage their anxiety so that they can keep fighting the fight, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the things this reminds us is that you need to recognize your audience when you're talking to people or when you're reaching out to people. There are plenty of people who are not worried enough. And so you know, they maybe need to be a little bit more worried. But if people are too worried and it's interfering with their ability to function in some way, then they need to be given sort of coping skills so they're not paralyzed. That doesn't help in any way.
So this is an interesting kind of philosophical question, because in my mind, you know, we want our reactions to things going on in the environment to be proportionate to the actual threat and sort of realistic. And it's impossible to know sort of in absolute terms or objectively what is the correct or appropriate level of anxiety or fear in the face of climate change. But it is possible that total panic is the appropriate or accurate kind of reaction. But it is possible that the appropriate reaction is a little bit further down in the other direction, maybe not complacency, but maybe a little bit concerned. So how do you think about the most adaptable response to these conditions?
Well, one way, and it may be different for different people, but one way I think about that is to remember that, you know, positive emotions and negative emotions are not two ends of a spectrum. Mm-hmm. They can coexist. You can have neither, you can have both, or you can have, mixes. I think that trying to maintain, if you don't have some level of negative emotion, you're, you know, as the signs say, you're not paying attention. Mm-hmm. So we need some of that, but we also need some positive emotion as well, in particular because, well, optimism is certainly associated with individual well-being, but optimism is what allows us to take action.
Right.
If you're a pessimist, then why bother? And I actually think there are people who fall back on pessimism as an excuse for doing nothing. Mm-hmm. Like, we're doomed, so I don't have to feel like I need to change my lifestyle in any way.
Right. So this kind of came up recently. I was at the big climate march in Montreal. I think it was at the end of September. And Greta Thunberg was there and she gave a big speech at the end. And one of the things that I get from her is that she's actually going around trying to make everybody more anxious about all of this. And when she's talking to the UN, maybe that is the appropriate message. But if she's going into a high school where, you know, the level of anxiety is high in general, and there's a bunch of kids that are very, very anxious about climate change, maybe that's not the right message, as you were suggesting earlier. Would you agree?
I would definitely say that the message is not right for everyone. Mm-hmm. So, high school students can mostly deal with anxiety. I would definitely not give that message to elementary school students. Uh-huh. So it's kind of finding out where that dividing line is. But you definitely, again, some people shouldn't be scared beyond their ability to cope with it.
Right, right.
So it's a combination of feel anxious, but how much sort of efficacy does that person feel? And high school students can feel quite effective. They can think, there are things I can do about this. I'm going to go out and march. I'm going to do what Greta did.
Right.
They might be able to cope with that level of anxiety.
Right. Okay, so if you're okay with it, I'd like to get into what we might do about all this. You know, the numbers you mentioned earlier indicate that there's a very, very large number of people that are probably looking for some tools or looking for new ways to think about it. And I have some questions for you about all that.
Please.
So what I've said to clients and journalists and stuff is that, first of all, I really appreciate the framing of this, you know, of this challenge in terms of the need is to build resilience. It acknowledges that there's a there's a big problem. It acknowledges that the problem is challenging to people, that it can create stress and anxiety, and we need to fortify ourselves and feel the emotions, but also cope and move on. So the recommendations I give to people are basically threefold, and I unpack each of them if you don't mind. The first is, and this is a tricky one, get your facts straight. So because climate change is abstract, it's complex, it's at a very large scale, the time frame is not clear, it really opens the door to lots of misunderstanding and, you know, the sort of cognitive distortions that drive anxiety and other mood problems. And so, and I've worked through these kinds of problems with clients in the past. And of course, you know, these exaggerated versions or these exaggerated narratives about climate change are amplified on social media and in the news. So this is a big problem, which is why I wanted to sort of lead off the top with what are the basic facts and how do we, and what do we know with some level of confidence is true scientifically. Maybe I can, I'll let you jump in here and say, like, are you seeing these kinds of exaggerated views, and do you think people are prone to anxiety because they haven't, they don't really understand what we're dealing with here?
I think to answer the second part of your question first, I think that's quite possible. But more generally, I absolutely think that there is some exaggeration. You know, you see people saying we're all doomed, our planet is on fire. I mean, neither of those things is true. There's some pretty serious challenges that we're facing, but I'm personally not anticipating extinction of the human race, you know, within the next 100 years. I'll go out on a limb and say
okay,
that.
Why is that?
So why? Well, we're talking about higher temperatures, but we're not talking about uninhabitable conditions on most of the world. Now, again, some of the effects are quite serious, and effects that people might not be aware of, like so it's not just the storms, but it's effects on food, the ability to grow food and the nutritional value of that food is a concern. The possibly the spread of new diseases, you know, as we see Lyme disease and Zika and so on, warmer temperatures make those disease vectors kind of more more threatening. But I don't think, you know, so I feel like we're trying to talk about resilience and I find myself defending how bad it is. Things can be quite bad. The population could shrink, but I don't think it's particularly likely that we'll become extinct as a species within the next 100 years.
Okay. Well, population shrinking sounds pretty scary.
Yes, I agree. I think that's, but the point is here that when people say we're all doomed, we're not all doomed.
Sure.
Some of us are doomed.
Okay.
If that makes
very reassuring. Thank you.
But specific information in my community in the next 20 years, what is going to happen? Probably not that much. So I think people do sometimes catastrophize.
Right. I feel like this is where the fact that climate change has become a political issue is really complicating things. And this is, I believe it's true in Canada, perhaps a bit less so, but certainly in the U.S., that typically we see people on the left side of the spectrum being more alarmist and people on the right side of the spectrum downplaying and being a little bit more complacent about it. And so we're sort of left trying to figure out, well, how bad is it? And, you know, so maybe in 20 years, that's reassuring that probably there won't be many effects, let's say in the Northeast US or how wide would you draw the circle around things being okay in the next 20 years?
Well, I guess I don't want to get into that that game of saying how okay will
right.
we be. We will probably have all noticed some effects. Some people will be much more badly affected than others. You know, I think for especially you're even better off than I am because you're farther north. You know, in 20 years, our lifestyles might not be that different. although I suspect they'll be somewhat different. I hope that they will be different and they will be using a whole lot less fossil fuel.
A lot of the estimates I've come across look at the changes on the time frame of like the end of the century, where we're talking about, you know, several feet of sea level rising, which could have very significant consequences. Do you have, I know this isn't really not your area of expertise, but again, for the sake of educating people so that they can have their thoughts straight to some extent, what do you foresee by 2100?
You know, that's a figure I don't have in the top of my mind. I would say we are already seeing people who live on coasts being displaced and experiencing more more erosion and more natural disasters. I feel fairly confident that that will increase. By 2100, there will probably have been some pretty significant changes. I don't think, well, I can't give you numbers. I think I would say I would not be buying coastal property right now. I don't think that, and now I'll probably get sued by somebody.
Okay. So Susan, what do you make of the sort of political divide, as I kind of alluded to a minute ago?
Well, I think it's incredibly unfortunate because it gets in the way of our addressing the problem. And, you know, there's been a lot written on this. I think the U.S. is one of the worst places in terms of the political polarization, but it's certainly not the only place. And it was not inevitable. You know, the Republican Party in the U.S. has not been the anti-environment party traditionally. In fact, many of our strongest environmental laws were passed by Republican administrations. So it's not so much, I think, about the content of the issue, but just the fact that the country has become polarized in general. And this has been a tool. And the fact that Al Gore was a prominent spokesperson and the Democratic candidate for president probably played a role there. But what it means now is that people aren't so much attending to the facts. And of course, we have a whole nother discussion on whether you people even agree about what facts are. But it's more about, does my side score points or does the other side score points? So they're ignoring the question in favor of just paying attention to what the political implications of it are. And I know that there are politicians on the right who would like to be doing more, but sometimes get political pressure to avoid addressing the issue. And so that's a huge problem because of the way it affects public policy. And again, in the U.S. right now, there's just terrible rollbacks of environmental protection, not because really anybody thinks they make sense, but because they are associated with a Democratic government and therefore we want to get rid of them. But even more than that, at an individual level, I think that can be one of the contributing factors to levels of anxiety because people are worried, but they don't know. They're worried. They don't necessarily want to bring up the issue because they don't want to be politically inappropriate. They don't want to they don't want to get into a political discussion. So a simple comment like, gee, I'm really worried about climate change might be responded to negatively if you're talking to somebody who considers themselves on the other end of the political spectrum. And so that fact that it's socially contested, I think contributes to anxiety and partly for a direct reason too, which is that you don't have confidence that the people in charge are going to do anything about it.
Absolutely. And it does raise the question of like, where does it leave individuals who are concerned or anxious about all this stuff, which I want to get into in one sec. To come back to 2100 for a second, I came across this analysis by an environmental economist, right, who's sort of looking at this in very quantitative terms. And the basic message that this analysis produced is that, yeah, so climate change might cause some problems in the global economy. It will affect the global GDP by 2 to 4%. which is not a trivial number, but it's also not enormous. And, you know, by 2100, we could be somewhere between 300 and 1000% richer. And so it's 2 to 4% less rich than we otherwise would have been, which is, and so in terms of the effect on our lifestyle now, it really is quite trivial. And so when you look at it through this lens, you know, you frame it this way, why isn't this just something that we will adapt to slowly, that we'll figure out how to deal with? Like, why be anxious at all?
Well, I think we will adapt to it. And I think that's a good way of thinking about it. But before going there, I want to totally reject the economist's comment that we will be whatever the figure you said was,
300 richer. 300 to 1,000% richer.
Yeah. And my reaction is, what do you mean we?
Right.
Because we are not all going to be richer.
And the global economy.
Right. But I'm not concerned about the global economy. I'm concerned about the fact that many, many people will be, because of climate change, will be significantly less well off than they are now. And so to say we'll be richer says to me that levels of inequality, economic inequality, will be even greater than they are now. But beyond that, to say richer is to define well-being totally in economic terms. And, you know, more and more people have recognized the limits of such an analysis. You've got, you know, Bhutan with their gross national happiness index. If we had more economic development at 2100 and our world is, you know, significantly degraded, that doesn't sound like a good thing to me. So I don't think we can just look at the impact in terms of the average economic effect. We really need to think about all the different things that contribute to our happiness and our life satisfaction. And we also need to think about the fact that different groups will be differently affected.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up. And that was the thing that I wanted to mention earlier that I forgot, that, you know, maybe in 20 years, no one in my community will be affected by climate change, but there may be a lot of people in different parts of the world or who are in less fortunate sort of material circumstances than I am in that could be severely affected. And so I know that you're very sensitive to this, and I just want to make sure it's part of our conversation that it is another kind of wedge related to inequality. And so it is disadvantaged people that are more likely to be affected by climate change, if I understand correctly.
Absolutely.
And what I think you're saying is that climate change will drive inequality further. Is that the case?
Yes. And one reason is purely geography. So, you know, the most developed countries, Western countries, tend to be not in the geographical areas that are being most affected. Africa, I think, is the continent that is already experiencing the most impacts. I believe the Arctic, the far north. So those people are already, they're going to experience temperature changes that are greater than the temperature changes we'll experience mm-hmm. here. But also being poor gives you fewer resources to cope with it. So, you know, if it gets really hot, I can buy an air conditioner. Actually, I do have an air conditioner. If food is no longer, you know, food is harder to come by, I can probably still afford to buy it. I can afford to buy bottled water if my water supply is threatened. But there are places around the world, and I'm sure you know this, where I think it was Johannesburg, where they ran out of water last year.
Right.
You know, places where they are losing access to those, you know, those real necessities of life. And I mean, I think it's good that we should care about other people, but I want to stress that even if you don't care about other people, inequality is a bad thing, because what happens when one country is doing pretty well and one country is doing really badly? They've got nothing to lose. You know, that's grounds for international conflict, it's grounds for terrorism. And meanwhile, the people who have more might have to spend more on security and, you know, live in gated communities, restricting access because they're afraid of the other people who don't have what they have. You know, inequality is not associated with happiness. Inequality is associated with decreased societal levels of well-being.
It's really interesting. I want to come back to this sort of economic analysis. And I'm totally with you that, you know, GDP is far from a good measure of human flourishing. But I do think it's interesting to think about the wealth of a society can be a powerful mitigator of the impacts of climate change. And you sort of alluded to it earlier. You know, when a hurricane hits Florida, it's very different from when a hurricane hits Guatemala, because there are resources in place, there's infrastructure in place to limit the damage basically and recover more quickly. And so is it not fair to say that wealth is a economic riches are an important factor in being resilient?
Yes. Yes, I would totally agree. But I would maybe qualify that and say that it also depends on a broader societal infrastructure. So you could be a very wealthy person living in a country that doesn't have the social support system, and your house could still get wiped out by a hurricane. And if there's not, you know, the first responders and the medical support and the ability to provide you with fresh water and so on, you're still going to suffer very badly. So, and whereas you could be a relatively less well-off person living in a society that has a stronger support network, or better building codes so that, you know, the city will withstand the storm better and come through that storm with reduced losses.
So maybe the issue is, because I come back to this point about, like, let's say the low end of the economic projection is that on average, the world is 300% richer. If there's a huge inequality and there is a smaller number of people benefiting from that increase, then the hurricane hitting Guatemala by 2100, it's still the same problem. But if that increase in wealth is more normally distributed, then it can help us mitigate the impact of climate change, and it will have less of an impact on humanity. Isn't that not fair to say?
Yes, absolutely. And if that increased wealth has allowed us to develop, you know, to develop new technologies and to, you know, disseminate technologies and infrastructure that we already have, it could definitely contribute to resilience. You know, by help people have cities that where the buildings don't collapse. You know, and where the water supply is guaranteed.
Right. Right. Okay, so I think this is a nice opportunity to move into the next part of my kind of structure here. And I mentioned this earlier, one of the things that I recommend to people is that they take action to cope with their eco-anxiety. What kind of action are you recommending people take if they're experiencing eco-anxiety?
Well, I'm definitely encouraging people to take action and I leave it to them to decide what they're comfortable with. I mean, I can certainly offer people my opinion about what will be the most effective thing to do, but some people might want to focus on changing their own lifestyles. Some people might want to get politically involved. So I think getting actively engaged in some way is more important in terms of personal resilience than a specific behavior.
So why is taking action helping build resilience?
There are two reasons. One of the things I think that underlies a lot of this anxiety is helplessness.
Yes.
So if you do something, you don't feel as helpless. You feel like you have been able to make a difference at some level. And that's really important. And then I think another fringe benefit is particularly, I encourage people not just to get engaged, but to find ways to engage with other people. Mm. So they're strengthening their social connections. And then there are all kinds of, you know, positive social experiences that can be involved. I think anyone who has, you know, participated in a rally or some sort of, you know, group organized event knows that fellow feeling and that, you know, sort of self-congratulation in a good way when you actually succeed in getting something done, or just that you've all experienced this together. So those positive emotions and social connections also contribute to resilience.
Right. And just for the record, and for the sake of the kind of structure or conversation, the third recommendation that I do give people is to stay connected to friends, family, colleagues around these issues, because it's important to not suffer alone. So we're on the same page there. You mentioned changing lifestyle or getting politically engaged. Let's unpack that, because sometimes when I think about changing my lifestyle, and I've changed my lifestyle significantly over the years, you know, there's that nagging doubt that is very difficult to shake, because it might actually be true. Does it really make a difference on global climate emissions if I take my bike to work rather than my car?
Exactly. I mean, and of course it doesn't. Of course, you know, your bicycle is not contributing, or if you drove to work instead of riding your bike, it would not contribute, it would not make a significant difference. But there are two ways, probably more than two, but two that occur to me that I think are good ways to respond to that. One is just that I think we need to find meaning in addressing the issue and not just focus on outcome, but focus on our own engagement. And this is true in so many other things, you know, any collective action issue. So does your individual vote matter? No, but I hope you voted anyway. Act as if your actions have meaning in and of themselves, even if they didn't lead to the desired outcome. But more than that, and here's where my, you know, social psychology perspective comes in. The emissions you save by riding your bike might not matter, but there are people who see you riding your bike, and that might make it, you know, slightly more likely that they too will ride their bike, or that they'll think about their carbon emissions and try and reduce them in some other way. And then for each person who you affected, they in turn can have an effect. So our ability to influence others as role models, I think, is really profound.
That's really interesting. I had not thought of that, and I think it's a very cool insight from social psychology. Now let's move on to the political stuff. Okay, so voting, obviously, and we just exercised our right here in Canada not too long ago. What are we supposed to do? I mean, in principle, we can make all kinds of lifestyle changes, and you could correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I picked up recently that individual citizens changing their lifestyles has had an impact on climate emissions in the world. But what hasn't changed is these bigger structural systemic things like corporate activity and government policy. So those are enormously important changes that need to be made if we're going to make any progress. So what are we supposed to do about this political gridlock?
Yeah, well, this is something I have to kind of keep reminding myself when I feel in despair about a political situation. But corporations and politicians do respond to individuals, not necessarily right away, not necessarily at all for, you know, in particular cases, but in the long run, they are motivated to, you know, especially corporations, they, you know, they have customers, or they have, you know, their social reputation matters. So if they can be convinced that people want them to change, they'll change. And, you know, there have certainly been cases, I mean, again, not my area of expertise, but I know that a lot of companies have done a lot of things to be more environmentally sustainable recently. Some of those have been just window dressing, but some of them have had actual impact. And, you know, politicians have suddenly, at least on the left, it's more, you know, everybody has to have a climate change position. So they're at least recognizing that the public wants to hear them talking about this issue.
Right. So I want to keep going with the role of the private sector. And I'm certainly not someone that, you know, wants to take a very punitive attitude towards corporations. I think they have the potential to play an enormous role in dealing with climate change. I'm sort of curious to hear how you would advise us to think about, you know, the sort of relative contribution. So I'm a little bit skeptical about a solution to climate change or the main solution to climate change, depending on people's willingness to, you know, reduce their consumption, change their lifestyle, and in many ways diminish their material comforts as compared to a new technology or a new set of technologies that really do change how we live in a sort of more paradigmatic way. How do you see this sort of relative impact of those two approaches?
Well, I would certainly like to think that there are some new technologies coming along that will allow us, that will get us off the hook in some ways, you know, that will help us to reduce air emissions. I'm not as pessimistic about lifestyle changes you are, because there have been lifestyle changes. And, you know, even now, for example, I spent 3 months living in London 1 year. And of course, I didn't have a car. And most people who live in the East don't have cars, especially in London, where you could barely drive it, and there was no place to park it, and there's good public transportation. And I came back home and I had a car again. So the circumstance, it's partly what, and in the, I think it's the Netherlands, which is particularly known for bicycling, and maybe I think Denmark. So it's not that, you know, the Dutch are fundamentally different from Americans, that they're genetically predisposed to ride their bicycles. It's that the culture encourages them, and then the infrastructure on top of that makes it easier. Mm-hmm. So we know these behaviors are within the realm of human possibility. There just has to be a shift in a particular culture to make them more likely. And I'm trying to think of an approximate time frame. Let's say, I'll be generous, 30 years ago, being a vegetarian in this country was pretty rare. You know, you could go all kinds of places and not find any vegetarian food to eat. And now it's a very rare restaurant that won't have vegetarian options, you know, and probably even vegan and perhaps even gluten-free. So that has been a lifestyle change. You know, just people moving to cities, that's urbanization is a trend around the world. There are ways in which that can enable more sustainable behavior. I guess one more thing I want to add about lifestyle changes is that a lot of people recognize problems with our current lifestyle that has nothing to do with environmental impact. You know, people will say, yeah, I think we're consuming too much. I think we throw away too much. I think we don't emphasize social activity. That doesn't necessarily mean that they will individually act to change those things, but I think there would be a receptivity to changing certain things.
Well, that analysis certainly does provide some optimism when you point out changes in how we eat in the last 30 years. And there are a number of other ways to think about how quickly we've actually evolved on this front. So that is encouraging. I think also about, I picked up this nice anecdote the other day, that in the 1860s, one of the most important sources of energy in the U.S. was fat from whales. And so these poor marine mammals were being fished almost to extinction until somebody drilled for oil, discovered oil, and discovered that it's a really efficient use of energy. And all of a sudden, we saved the whales. And that was that sort of wholesale shift to a different way of living that had this like environmental upside. And it points to the importance of finding new technologies to be able to do what we want to keep being able to do. What do you see as the technologies that we should really be thinking about investing in and supporting in the years to come?
Yeah, well, definitely alternative sources of fuel, I think, has got to be number one. And it seems to me that I'm always reading about new advances that if we devoted more resources to supporting research into renewable fuel sources, there's every chance that we could make, you know, I think there are some big discoveries coming, but they could come mm-hmm. more quickly if we invested in them more. So that's sort of the most directly related to technology. I guess I would say this may or not count as technology, but changing the way we think about the things we build, you know, the transportation systems in particular, but also buildings. There's just buildings and industry. There's a whole lot of opportunities for energy efficiency that we could exploit and save a lot right there.
Okay, well, I'm mindful of your time here, and we're across the 1 hour mark. And so I'm wondering if there's anything else that we haven't talked about you think belong in this conversation.
Well, two things, and you can decide whether to include them or not. One is I want to, highlight the possibility of food systems as, you know, and changing the way we approach eating as one important part of mitigating climate change. I think a lot of people don't recognize the way in which food is involved and the kind of carbon footprint of food. And sometimes it boils down to, okay, well, you have to either, you know, you can either keep eating what you're eating or you can totally go vegan. There are no points. But I think just for people to try to reduce, for example, the amount of red meat they eat, but also to reduce their food waste, which I love because it doesn't require a single sacrifice. You know, you can have everything you want, just don't have more than you want because that food waste is enormous. Just a much bigger contributor to greenhouse gas emissions than people are aware of.
Can you flesh that out? Why is food waste a significant source of greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, it's partly because food themselves, you know, food, producing the food, transporting the food, and stocking the food, that uses energy, that uses fossil fuels. So if we're producing more and transporting more than we need, that's just a big impact right there. But actually also when the food goes into a landfill, it decays and it produces greenhouse gases. Hmm. So that's not insignificant.
Can I just ask you?
Yeah.
Any strategies or any ways of thinking about reducing food waste? Like, this is a great example because I love to eat. I love food, and food is an important sort of reward for me. And so that's a hard one for me in terms of like, oh, maybe I'll just get one less thing, or, you know, I won't buy that extra serving for myself. Like, how do you recommend we think about reducing something that's so important?
Well, I think it's a good point that food is really important. It's important to us individually, and it has great cultural importance.
Right.
And
right.
I also like food a lot. But, you know, when we talk about food waste, don't buy that extra thing for yourself if you're not going to eat it. If you're going to eat it, fine.
So complicated.
Right. I think that, you know, and this, I know it can take time, but to plan your weekly meals ahead of time and just not, I struggle with this myself, you know, oh my gosh, I bought a head of cauliflower and mm-hmm. I loved that first meal. And then I still have all this cauliflower left. And what am I going to do with it? So kind of trying to plan out, a meal schedule for a certain amount of days, as opposed to just buying mm-hmm. the stuff and then hoping you'll figure out what to do with it later.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I cut you off. What was the other issue you wanted to add?
Oh, just an emphasis on, you know, the possibilities of transformation. I do think, I mean, people, it's always hard to believe that change is going to happen, but actually, you know, social change has happened enormously in my lifetime. I mean, just in terms of the internet and smartphones, which are relatively new. Mm-hmm. I mean, my students, you know, did not, they got them when they were in middle school or high school, but they didn't grow up with them. And yet I think we would all agree that smartphones have completely changed the way we live our lives.
Right.
So, and inventions are happening faster and faster. So I think more and more things are on the way. And that, so I think it's helpful to think not just, oh my God, this terrible climate change stuff is happening and we're going to have to change our lives and it's all going to be bad. But to recognize that this is kind of an opportunity to change society in hopefully some ways that will be good. Because again, I think most people would say there's ways in which society could be improved right now. And maybe the kinds of changes that climate change will force us to make will be changes that actually have other benefits.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a lovely point to sort of bring our conversation to a close. I really appreciate all of your thoughtfulness here and taking the time to talk to me today. So thank you so much.
Sure. Friday afternoon was definitely the best time to schedule this.
All right. So wishing you a great weekend.
Thanks. Same to you.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Mindspace podcast. I hope it was inspiring. If you feel the world could use a little more Mindspace, please consider supporting the podcast. The best way to do that is to leave a review on the Apple Podcast app or wherever you listen, or share your favorite episode on social media. Thanks and be well.